Welcome to SCOTUSCast. On November 26, 2007, the court heard oral argument in LaRue v. DeWolf regarding whether or not Section 502A2 or 502A3 of ERISA gives rise to an action for breach of fiduciary trust by an employee claiming the trustees of the defined contribution retirement plan failed to make investments the employee directed and that would have given a higher value than those the trustees actually made. On December 3, 2007, the court heard arguments in Sprint United Management Co. v. Mendelson, which asks about the admissibility in a case involving an employee's claim of employment discrimination, based on the conduct of one supervisor, of testimony of the other employees about the conduct of other supervisors. In this episode of SCOTUSCast, Shai Dovratsky, attorney in the D.C.-based law firm Jones Day, discusses these two cases. As always, the Federalist Society itself takes no particular position on legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, attorney Dovratsky.
My name is Shai Dvoretsky. I'm a lawyer with Jones Day in Washington, D.C. The Supreme Court recently heard argument in two important cases involving labor and employment law. LaRue v. DeWolf Boberg & Associates concerns whether an employee can sue an employer under ERISA, the Employee Retirement Income Security Act, for breach of fiduciary duty involving a 401k account. Sprint United Management Company v. Mendelson involves the circumstances in which a plaintiff alleging disparate treatment under the ADEA, the Age Discrimination in Employment Act, can introduce evidence of alleged discrimination against other employees who worked for different supervisors. Turning to the LaRue case first, an employee, James LaRue, asked his employer to make certain changes to the way in which his 401k funds were invested. He wanted to sell one mutual fund and buy another instead. For some reason, that change was never made. 2 years later, Mr. LaRue sued his employer for about $150,000, which was the amount of profit that he claimed he lost because the change was never made. The district court dismissed Mr. LaRue's complaint, and the Fourth Circuit affirmed. The United States supported Mr. LaRue's petition for certiorari, which the Supreme Court granted. Mr. LaRue relies on two provisions of ERISA, Sections 502A2 and 502A3. Section 502A2 allows recovery of, quote-unquote, any losses to the plan that results from a breach of fiduciary duty. Mr. LaRue argues that the plan itself is just a collection of individual accounts, so the loss to his individual account is necessarily a loss to the plan. The employer argues that the statute requires a collective injury, and that Mr. LaRue can't recover for a breach of fiduciary duty that affected only one participant. The Fourth Circuit agreed with the employer, relying also on a Supreme Court case called Massachusetts Mutual Life Insurance v. Russell, in which the court, in dicta, described Section 502A2 as allowing recovery of, quote-unquote, losses to the entire plan and losses to the plan as a whole. The employer also argues as a policy matter that allowing lawsuits for breach of fiduciary duty that affect just one participant would lead to countless claims against employers and would greatly increase the cost of offering 401k plans. The other provision on which Mr. LaRue relies, Section 502A3, authorizes a plaintiff to seek, quote-unquote, appropriate equitable relief. The classic form of equitable relief, of course, would be an injunction requiring the employer to make the change that Mr. LaRue requested. But that's not the relief that Mr. LaRue wanted. He wanted to recover lost profits. And the Supreme Court has developed a rather complicated body of law concerning what kinds of monetary relief are equitable within the meaning of ERISA. In cases such as Mertens v. Hewitt Associates and Great West Life and Annuity Insurance Company v. Knudsen, the court has asked whether a particular kind of relief was typically available in courts of equity or not. So, for example, restitution seeking recovery of specific funds is generally considered equitable, but restitution that seeks to impose personal liability on a defendant is considered legal relief. In this case, Mr. LaRue argues that while he's not seeking specifically identifiable funds as in equitable restitution, he's asking for the equitable remedy of surcharge, which he describes as a doctrine in equity that allowed recovery for breaches of a trustee's duties. The employer argues, and the Fourth Circuit agreed, that Mr. LaRue is seeking nothing more than monetary damages in the legal sense. It's always tricky at best to try to predict an outcome based on an oral argument in the Supreme Court. But the justices' questions in this case provided some insights. For the most part, they seem sympathetic to the point of statutory argument that Section 502A2 allows recovery of any losses to the plan, and a loss to his account is necessarily a loss to the plan. Conversely, they seem skeptical of the employer's reading of the statute, which would require the court to draw some intelligible line delineating how many participants need to be affected before Section 502A2 comes into play. At the same time, however, the justices' questions also tested the limits on a plaintiff's right to sue under Section 502A2. Justice Scalia, for example, suggested that a plaintiff might not be able to sue an employer under that provision without first trying to get the money directly from the plan through an action under another provision of ERISA, Section 502A1B, that wasn't argued in this case. Justice Alito suggested that Mr. LaRue may have waived his Section 502A2 argument by not adequately pleading that claim in his complaint. And Chief Justice Roberts asked whether the absence of the plan documents in the record may be dispositive against Mr. LaRue. As for the Section 502A3 claim, the justices spent very little time on that issue, perhaps reflecting a preference to avoid the difficult historical inquiry into the lines between law and equity. One possibility, if the court rules in Mr. LaRue's favor on the 502A2 claim, is that it won't need to decide the A3 issue because equitable relief may not be, quote-unquote, appropriate within the meaning of Section 502A3 if relief is available under another provision of ERISA. At bottom, this is a very important case because it presents the question of who bears the risk of administrative errors in connection with 401k plans. Some such errors are probably inevitable. And if every misplaced enrollment form or mishandled trade can give rise to a six-figure federal lawsuit, the cost of administering and offering these plans could increase dramatically. Congress, of course, was trying to strike a balance in ERISA between allowing employees to protect their rights on the one hand and limiting employers' exposure to liability for offering voluntary benefit plans on the other hand. We don't know on the limited record of this case why the change that Mr. LaRue requested wasn't made, or why he took 2 years to sue. In the vast majority of cases, if an employee follows up on a trade request, it will probably be made, without any need to end up in federal court. There's also the possibility, though again, we don't know that it happened here, that a plaintiff in Mr. LaRue's position will purposely wait until well into the limitations period in order to sue, to see how the market performs, and whether he would be better off with the mix of investments that he actually has, or with lost profits for the mix of investments that he requested and never got. For that reason, if the court does rule in the plaintiff's favor here, it might be wise to clarify that an employer would be entitled to assert a laches defense in appropriate circumstances. As for the Sprint case, the plaintiff, Ellen Mendelson, was laid off by Sprint in 2002. In response to economic conditions in the telecommunications industry, Sprint downsized its payroll by about 15,000 workers. Ms. Mendelson, who at the time was 51 years old, claimed that she was chosen for layoff because of her age. She filed a charge with the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, which found no evidence of an ADEA violation, and she then sued Sprint in federal court. Ms. Mendelson first asserted, but then apparently abandoned, a claim that Sprint had engaged in a pattern or practice of age discrimination affecting her as well as others. Before trial, Sprint filed a motion in limine to exclude the proposed testimony of five former Sprint employees who claimed that they, too, had been released based on age in layoffs that were conducted in other departments by other managers, though within a year of Ms. Mendelson's layoff and as part of the same overall reduction in force. In light of Ms. Mendelson's apparent abandonment of her pattern of practice claim, Sprint argued that this evidence was irrelevant under Federal Rule of Evidence 401 and that it should, in any event, be excluded as confusing, prejudicial, and unnecessary under Rule 403. Of the five witnesses, three sought to testify that they had heard discriminatory remarks on the basis of age by Sprint supervisors in departments other than Ms. Mendelson's. One sought to testify that she had seen a spreadsheet suggesting that age was a factor that another supervisor, though again not Ms. Mendelson's supervisor, considered in making his layoff decisions. A fourth witness would have testified that he received a false negative evaluation by a supervisor because of age. And a fifth employee would have testified that he was laid off and replaced by a younger worker. None of these five witnesses worked in Ms. Mendelson's group. None of them worked under Ms. Mendelson's direct supervisor, that supervisor's supervisor, or that supervisor's supervisor. Sprint, therefore, argued that although these witnesses all alleged discriminatory layoffs within about a year of Ms. Mendelson's layoff, their testimony should be excluded because it didn't shed any light on the motives of Ms. Mendelson's supervisor in selecting her for layoff. The district court granted Sprint's motion and ordered that only former employees who were laid off by Ms. Mendelson's supervisor in close temporal proximity to her layoff could testify about their own circumstances. The district court did not expressly make clear whether that order was a relevance determination under Rule 401 or the result of balancing under Rule 403. After an 8-day trial, the jury returned a verdict in favor of Sprint. The Tenth Circuit reversed in a 2-1 decision, holding that the district court had abused its discretion in excluding the evidence of the 5 witnesses. The Court of Appeals held that the testimony of these other employees was relevant under Rule 401 as proof of a company-wide policy of discrimination in connection with the reduction in force. The Court of Appeals further held that the district court had no discretion to exclude this evidence under the balancing test of Rule 403. The upshot of the Tenth Circuit's holding is that a district court trying an ADEA case must admit all testimony of workers other than the plaintiff who claim to have suffered the same sort of bias against them, even if they worked for a different supervisor or in a different work unit than the plaintiff, as long as they worked for the same employer. Before the Supreme Court, Sprint argued principally that the evidence in question did not meet the threshold requirement of relevance under Rule 401. Sprint argues that, in an individual disparate treatment case, liability under the ADEA can only be shown by demonstrating discriminatory intent on the part of the person who made the relevant employment decision, that is, on the part of the supervisor who selected Ms. Mendelson for layoff. Sprint concedes that there may be some instances in which evidence of discrimination against other employees, what Sprint calls Me Too evidence, is relevant. For example, where another employee claims to have been discriminated against pursuant to a directive from upper management that would also shed light on the treatment of the plaintiff. But here, Sprint argues, the witnesses in question simply wanted to tell their own stories. They had no information suggesting that Ms. Mendelson's supervisor discriminated against her. As a fallback, Sprint also argues that even if the evidence in question is relevant, it should have been excluded under Rule 403, because it would have been prejudicial and confusing and would have caused undue delay. Ms. Mendelson argues that because direct evidence of a supervisor's discriminatory mindset is hard to come by, plaintiffs have to rely on the sort of circumstantial evidence that may be provided by the testimony of other employees who claim that they were discriminated against by different supervisors. She argues that this testimony is relevant because it shows a culture or atmosphere of discrimination at the company, which makes it more probable that Ms. Mendelson's particular supervisor was acting in accordance with that culture when he selected her for layoff. And Ms. Mendelson says that any concerns of prejudice or delay can be addressed through jury instructions and case management orders by the trial court. The Solicitor General also weighed in on this case. The Solicitor General agrees with the Tenth Circuit and with Ms. Mendelson that evidence of discrimination against other employees may be relevant depending on the plaintiff's theory of the case. But the Solicitor General disagrees with the Tenth Circuit that such evidence is per se admissible under Rule 403. The Solicitor General urges the court to remand this case so that the district court can conduct an express balancing under Rule 403. As for the ultimate outcome of this case, it seems likely that the court will reverse the Tenth Circuit, at least in part, and reject that court's per se rule of admissibility for so-called Me Too evidence. By the end of the oral argument before the Supreme Court, even Ms. Mendelson's lawyer had conceded, in response to a question by Justice Souter, that a remand to the district court for Rule 403 balancing would be appropriate. As for the relevance question, even if a plaintiff should be entitled to show a culture of discrimination, it's hard to see how the isolated testimony of 5 employees out of a company like Sprint that has 70,000 employees shows a culture and satisfies even the low threshold of Rule 401. With a large organization like Sprint, any plaintiff is likely to be able to find some small number of disgruntled former employees who think they were treated unfairly. That kind of isolated evidence doesn't rise to the level of a culture. Several justices at oral argument, Chief Justice Roberts and Justices Scalia and Kennedy, for example, questioned what evidence would not be relevant if the testimony here were held to satisfy Rule 401. The more likely outcome on which at least five justices might agree in this case, however, would turn on Rule 403. Justices Souter and Breyer, for example, suggested that a district court should at least be allowed to consider excluding Me Too evidence under Rule 403 to prevent trials, as Justice Breyer put it, from lasting 1,000 years, as the parties dispute the circumstances of employees other than the plaintiff. That raises the question whether the district court here actually conducted a balancing under Rule 403, in which case presumably no remand would be necessary, or whether the district court's order is better read as relying only on Rule 401. This case may best be understood as a case not involving one particular rule of evidence, but Article 4 of the Rules of Evidence as a whole. Whatever the relevance of Me Too evidence under Rule 401 in a particular case, that evidence will often raise the sorts of concerns that Rules 403 and also 404 are designed to account for. To the extent plaintiffs try to use such evidence to prove a general propensity of a corporate defendant to favor younger workers, a district court may conclude that this is the sort of character evidence that Rule 404 is designed to keep out. And whatever the relevance of such evidence under Rule 401, a district court should be able to decide that it unfairly prejudices or confuses the jury by focusing attention on employees other than the plaintiff, or that its prejudicial effect outweighs any benefit. The ultimate significance of this case may turn less on its result or its holding than on the broader guidance that the Supreme Court gives to district courts on how they should account for these various considerations in deciding whether to allow Me Too testimony to be admitted.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. For more episodes of SCOTUSCast, as well as audio and video from past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.